Hey, Tamina. Well, student lecturer here. Today, we have Ori Gura. He's a student case identity of in our school and advisor Raju, Professor Raju for performing. Currently, he's working on designing new interface for storage system and improving the energy efficiency of storage system. He has had a bachelor in computer science from Simón Bolívar University in Venezuela. And he is also a recipient of IBM PhD fellowship in 2010-2011. Please welcome our speaker.
Started about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, and it's gotten a lot of attention within other professors. Initially, it was just Raju and I, and it's gotten now in total more than 11 people involved, I believe. And the project is called Software Persistent Memory. And let me just go into give a little background of what it's about. So scientific applications, which I would also refer to as ATC, which is stands for high energy computing, are in a lot of machines at the same time, and it gets complicated, right? So you have a couple of choices. One, you can start over, re-execute everything from the beginning, but this takes a lot of time. Another option, which is the traditional solution to this problem, is to make while you're executing, at some point in time, save the state of the application to the disk, and if it fails, then at some later point in time, when you're recovering, you just recover from that state and continue your execution. This saves significantly amount of time. However, it also takes a lot of time to do these checkpoints. And particularly because that write to disk operation is orders of magnitude slower than traditional memory operations that the application is doing on its regular time, right? So there are two key observations that we use to reduce the time it takes to make a checkpoint. The first observation is that if we look at checkpoints 1 and 2, we from a traditional checkpointing application, we see that from checkpointing 1 to checkpointing 2, you actually added a little bit more data. However, if you look at the overall checkpoint, the fraction of what changed is actually very small, typically an order of magnitude less than the actual size of the checkpoint, right? And it gets even worse, because if you look at, if you have insider knowledge about what the application is doing, then you notice that you actually need a very small fraction of these changes to recover the application state. And it's, again, another order of magnitude difference usually from the changes to what's needed for recovery. And this is something that we leverage, right? However, if you were to do this by yourself, you were to implement an application recovery system by yourself, it's not very easy. And I'm going to go into the details why it's not easy, right? So imagine that you have a simple structure that we already know about, a binary balance tree, and you want to make it persistent. There are a couple of things that you need to do. The first thing is that you know everything that you need to make persistent, right? So every time that you create, let's say, a malloc, you need to, instead of knowing where that malloc is, and so that when you want to write it to this, you know exactly what portion of memory you want to write to this. That can be a little bit complicated when the application starts growing and growing. The other thing is that you need to keep track of changes to data structures. So let's look at this example. Initially, we have this tree. So, like I said, it's a binary balance tree. And let's say we want to insert item 17, right? So we would end up with this tree, right? So here we're in a situation where this node is in balance, and we need to balance it. When we inserted 17, notice that node 15 changed, and 17 also changed. And after we balance, things get worse, because you actually have that half of the tree change, right? So keeping track of all this will get complicated as as your tree grows, and even if and this is just for a simple tree, right? And the final thing that you would need to do is that you would need to know how to serialize this data structure. And you would also need to know how to deserialize it. Which, it's a little complicated, but it's feasible, right? We've all done that at a given point in time with arbitrary data structures. Okay, so our goals for our system are the following. So we would want to have the developer specify, yes, when top-level data structures begin. Say, what you need to recover your state is just a tree and a list. So you would want to specify where the tree starts, the head of the tree, and the head of the list. And that would be it. Our application will manually figure out what are everything that needs to be persistent for you without any other step. The other thing that developer needs to know is when to make checkpoints, right? And he needs to know when the application is in a consistent state so he can make checkpoints. This is something that we left to the developer to figure out because it's very application dependent, right? It's not something that that you can just do at any given time because, for instance, if you have inter-process communication, you want to have your communication in a specific state such that you're not communicating with the other peers at that given point in time, for instance. And the last thing that the developer needs to specify is how to recover from an execution from a given set of data, right? From the data he restores. Then our solution will usually require minimal changes to data structures or give more details into what those changes are. Like I said before, you will automatically detect all data to be checkpointed. Also, it will track changes to data and make those checkpoints as small as possible by only checkpointing modifications. And it will minimize checkpoint creation time by optimizing for the hardware we're actually writing to and making them asynchronous. I'll go into more details into all these points later on the talk. So here's our solution. So like I said in the beginning, it's called software persistent memory. So the first thing to note is that it's a type of application-directed checkpointing. So in comparison with traditional checkpointing, here the application is aware that checkpointings are going on and actually has control to when to start them and how to recover from those checkpoints, right? So data to be checkpointed is automatically discovered, like I said, and checkpoints are fast and recovery is also fast. So the way it works is that basically, since you're only going to store what actually changed and what's actually needed for recovery, your checkpoints are going to be a lot smaller than the traditional checkpoints. Thus, the recovery time is going to be also smaller than the traditional recovery time. Okay. So, all of this is in... Yes?
Checkpointing is always done by the synchronous, I think it's done by the application level, right?
No, so there are... When I was referring to checkpoints, I mean, there are two types of checkpointing. So you can do either system-level checkpoint, where you basically take all the processes that are executing and make a snapshot of their memory at a given point in time.
Just give an example, like a Windows machine. I mean, Windows can checkpoint itself as a system.
Yeah, that's system-level checkpointing.
And just Microsoft Word.
Yeah, exactly. So application directed checkpoint is when the application guides the checkpoint, tells the checkpoint when to do it, and how to recover from it.
But that checkpointing is already implemented at the application level. Many applications do that.
Some applications do it, but the thing is that if you were to do it for every application, it's a lot of work, right? Our solution, the idea is that we implement this, provide this library, and any application can have persistence guarantees just by using our library.
Okay.
And without having them to do all that work.
Okay?
So data is encapsulated in something that we call containers. Right? Each container.
So that means it's another question, what happens when there is a conflict? I mean, an application who wants to implement on its own and you are trying to provide them as a checkpoint service. I mean, they can just bypass and they use their own checkpoint.
So I mean, there will not be any conflict at that point because the way we manage is that memory is I mean, he's gonna do his checkpoint in his own way, but also we're gonna do our checkpoint in our own way, and they will not conflict because we're all gonna be accessing memory, right? And we're not modifying any system level.
Here, the unless application tells you to do checkpoints, you will do it.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, because there's a notion of that the application needs to be in a consistent state, right? Okay. So, like I said, we have the container abstraction, which means that, and a container is a collection of memory that is pointed to that you can. It's basically a memory closure calculated from a root structure. That the developer provides, and the other thing is that one important thing is that a container is storable within a single atomic operation. I will also go into more details of this later. When we initially created the design, we envisioned two types of container. First, the simple container, and also a version container. And in a version container, you don't only have access to the last checkpoint that you created, but you also have access to previous checkpoints that you created. So if you want to go back to a previous time in execution, you can easily browse through it and recover that particular version, right? Okay, so I'm going to go into a little bit more detail of how do we automatically discover the data. So at any given point in time, memory, we partition memory into two portions. Volatile, that is the usual memory that you allocate using typical calls, say malloc, and persistent. So having this two types of memory gives you introduces four different types of pointers, right? The first one is a pointer from volatile to volatile memory. Second are pointers from volatile to persistent memory. Then there are the ones those from going from persistent to volatile, and the ones that are persistent to persistent. The ones that we pay particularly interest to are those that cross boundaries, the ones that come from volatile to persistent or that go to persistent to volatile. And here's why we pay attention to them. Imagine that at some given point in time we have this root structure and we have these two lists in volatile memory. So the way we calculate the closure for this root structure is very simple. We start by traversing this first pointer, creating a copy of this data in persistent memory. Then we fix the pointer, we make it now fixed to this new item that we just copied there, free the previous location, and then simply continue, repeat this process until we run out of pointers, right? So at some point in time, there are going to be no more pointers crossing from here to here. However, there are going to be pointers that were pointing to data that we just moved. And those cannot be left that way. So for those pointers, we have to fix them. We call this back references. So our last step in this closure calculation is fixing those back references, making them point to the new location where we moved them. Okay, so this, like I said, this root structure and its memory closure is what composes a single container. Right? Okay, so in terms of what the developer needs to modify from the program is, it basically needs to allocate these containers and specify the root structure, like for instance, in this case, it would be just specifying the pointer to the head of the list, and then at some point in time, invoke a persistent point creation. Then what will SoftPM will do is that if you imagine that you have this type definition where you have a simple list that has an in and an x, you will typically use it this way, just allocate data for it. What SoftPM will do is first it will register all the locations of the malloc. In this case, we'll say, okay, you have a malloc of L, L is a malloc and is of size n. And it will register all the pointers that that are containing this data structure. Right? In this case, L itself and the pointer to the next element that we see here. I notice that this code is generated automatically by a static analysis of the code that, that we do prior to running the system. Yes?
Okay, so I think it follows a simple example. What about when you have objects pointing to other objects with various things going on, possibly cycles back to the original object? How do you handle that?
Yeah, so, yeah, I imagine that question was coming. So,
did you imagine it in this way?
No, yeah, I mean, and the reason is, and the question, the answer to the question is very simple. So, when we, let's say we're back here, right? And at some given point in time, so we're here, at a stage where, let me start again. So, let's say that there's another, there's this guy points to, let's say there's another pointer here to a memory that was already moved, right? So let's say that this guy, at this point, there's another additional pointer from this guy to this guy. So what's going to happen is that when you traverse that pointer, you're going to figure out that that memory has already moved, right? So you're just going to update it to point it to this other region. So if there are cycles, we don't care about them. If there's aliasing, it's not going to affect our system because we're just traversing pointers and making sure that they're consistent in terms of what they point to. Yes?
But is this another threat of control trying to traverse to V4 while you're moving?
Yeah, so, yeah. Thanks for bringing up that question. So this operation, we do it atomically, right? We stop the system we stop execution and do all the memory movements that we need to do and then resume execution, right? So that sort of thing doesn't happen. Okay? So let me... Okay? Okay, so like I was saying, all this is done via static analysis of the code that we do before executing. Okay, so let me bring up another example of how we would actually go and recover, right? So let's start with this code. Again, we have a list, and we have a function A that simply creates a list of three elements, right? So you have this list of three elements, and you want to make this persistent, right? So what our library will do is that what the developer will do to make it persistent is that it will specify a root structure. In this case, it's just the root structure will just contain a pointer to the list, to the head of the list, and it will verify that container doesn't exist before, and if it doesn't, it will allocate it. Okay, let me go step by step. So, at this point, when the program starts, the process is going to have, let's say, three memory pages, right? So the first memory page is going to be, it's going to contain the actual container, right? So here, O0 is going to be the offset in page 0, of the container itself. Then when you allocate an additional element, let's assume it's going to be allocated in persistent memory. So you allocate the object here, and you in your pointer list you specify that in page one you have a pointer in offset one. Then here you just simply make the assignment, and that creates this pointer here. You add a value. Then when you allocate another element, you also register its pointers. And another assignment, another pointer creation, and our last malloc, and then we decide to create a persistent point, right? So when we create the persistent point, basically all these pages get written to some location in disk. Okay, so then how do we restore? So what happens when we restore? Restoring, let's get back to this if. So the first thing that we need to do is that we need to know where a page was, the address where it previously was, and where it is right now. Right? So we start by loading pages one by one. Okay. Loading pages one by one to new locations, right? So we record all those. So page one is now in location PI, page two is in location PJ, and page three is in location PK. So right now, we cannot just start executing the program again because the pointers are pointing to locations that are not valid. Because if you see, they're pointing to their previous locations, right? So that's the first thing that we need to do. We need to fix those pointers. And that's and to do that, we just simply say, okay, we start with the first page, and say, okay, what pointers in this list are originating in page one? Say, okay, this is first one, so I fix it. Now it points to page zero and the offset A zero. Offset A zero is simply calculated. Like I said, it's an offset within the page, so it remains static. The only thing that will change is the actual location of the page, right? The same thing for the next pointer, and our other pointer, right? So at this point, all these pointers are valid, but we have one last pointer, which is this one, and we also fix it. And then we look at our last page and see that there are no pointers to fix, right? And at that point, we're finished. There are no other modifications that we do. From now on, the remaining of the recovery phase is in charge of it's responsibility of the developer, right? Okay. So getting to the architecture part, SoftPM will provide three main functionalities, and today I'm only talking about recoverability. However, we do provide them via an API that we already designed, and it's going to be finished in the future. And that API communicates with another component that we call Lima, that apart from being the capital of Peru, stands for Location Independent Memory Allocator. It has four components: Container Manager, that will manage allocations and deallocations of containers; Discovery and Reorganization, that will do all that memory closure calculation; a Write Handler, that will track which pages are dirty, that means that they have been modified since the last persistent point; and a flusher that will make a persistent point to this other component that we call SID, which has two main components, the main one being a transaction handler to make those persistent points atomic, and a chunk remapper to optimize the way it writes to disk. So this, in order to optimize performance, we created three different modules for each different disk type. In particular, right now we have a hard disk module, an SSD module, and a parallel file system module. Okay, so the API is very simple. It's basically composed of some calls to allocate containers, either allocate, free it, or delete it. Notice that the difference between free and delete is that free just frees the container in this execution, and deletes the container from the disk. Then we have other calls for persistence management, most important being the create a persistent point and persistent point sync, which makes sure that our persistent point is actually written to disk and we can later recover it. And for restoring, we have restore, and these two calls are for the other functionalities that I'm not going to go through in this talk. Okay, so the page table for our container looks somewhat like this. We have an outer page directory, which has some metadata and two levels of indirection. In the page table entry, we have allocation units. This is because for each entry in the page table and in the page table, what we're going to do is that we're going to always allocate a page, right? And every time, and let's say, even if we say if we just have an allocation of say 10 bytes, we're always going to allocate a page, so that when another allocation for 10 bytes comes, we don't simply generate another call to allocation, but we service it in the same page. And this is the purpose of this bitmap, right? So for those of you who know operating system design, this is what's called a slab allocator, right? Where you have slabs of memory and you simply put those elements into those different slabs of memory. Okay? And in particular, the first three pages are special. Well, the first two pages are special because the first PTE always points to the root structure, and the second one points to the start of the pointer list. Right, so that's something that's static among all the containers. What's from here onward always will vary depending on the usage. Okay, so when you allocate a container, there are three things that you need to do. The first thing is to initialize the metadata. Then, by metadata, I mean runtime metadata. Second, create the container page table, that one that we just saw. And then initialize the pointer list, initially empty, of course. And then when you restore, you're just going to basically load all the container first, like we saw in the example, then fix pointers, and then just return a pointer to the root structure, right? So from that root structure that's restored, the developer is going to know how to recover the application of the state, the execution of the application, sorry. Okay. So container discovery. We did an example of this, and we looked at how it recursively follows all the pointers until the closure is complete, and then creates a persistent point from that memory closure. And like I said, in order to calculate this memory closure, we have to be aware of all memory allocations. So we take that information and we manage it. And also, that division between volatile and persistent regions, And the other thing that this guy does is that it fixed back references after moving the pointer so that during a consistent state, memory state for the application. Okay, so when a write occurs, there are some important things that happen that I need to clarify. So the first thing is that writes are monitored at the granularity of the chunk, which is just a group of pages. And what happens is that we initially mark all pages as read-only, such that when a write happens, we get a page fault. And that page fault, when that page fault occurs, we just simply mark that page as dirty, so that we know we need to make it persistent the next time we create a persistent point. And then allow the write to go on and continue execution. The other important capability of this write handler is that it allows you to do asynchronous checkpoints using copy and write pages. And the way this works is as follows. So imagine that at some point in time, we have four persistent memory chunks. One of them is still marked as write-only since the last time we made a persistent memory chunk. Since the last time we made a persistent point, so we don't need to include it in our persistent point, right? So the first thing that we do when we create a persistent point is that we mark all memory pages as write-only and as copy-on-write, indicated by this red box here, right? So to start creating the persistent point, we first write the first page to disk, and then when we're writing the second page to disk, a write comes to this first page. So if a write comes to this first page, we simply, like I said, let it go through and resume execution. However, if a write comes for this other page that is marked as not only read-only but also copy and write, We make sure that the application can continue while the persistent point is still being written to disk. So what we do is that we create a copy of this page, and we make the persistent point point to this new copy of this page, and then let the write proceed. Okay, so finally, after we've written that page, we simply write our last page of the persistent point, and then we're done. And at this point, the persistent memory is at this state where two pages are remain locked. Right? Okay. So in terms of the bottommost component of our system, the storage I/O driver, there are three main challenges that we face during this time. The first one is high performance I/O. That is that we want it to be optimized depending on the type of device it was writing to. This means that if we're writing to a hard drive, we're going to do the writes in a particular way. If we're writing to an SSD, we're going to do the writes in another different way. And if we're writing to a parallel path system, we're also going to do writes in a different way. So the way we do writes is specialized depending on each type of device. Secondly, and most importantly, is that all the persistent point operations are atomic. And that for that, we use a transactional scheme. So that either a persistent point operation fully completes or doesn't complete, right? And the way we do this is that we have a basic transactional system. We have a marker for start of a transaction in the persistent medium, and then when we finish that transaction, we add another marker indicating that the transaction is fully done, so that we know if everything is actually completed or not. And the last point that is very important is scalability. So by this I mean that, so like I said at the beginning of my talk, we're targeting high performance computing or high energy computing. And those applications, you typically run more than one at a time. And you're going to have more than one application writing persistent points at a given time. So if you simply allocate a static portion for each of those applications, your performance is going to be really bad. So the way what we do is that we make the system be optimized for creation of persistent points, and that is that we ensure that all writes are sequential when we're writing, and that guarantees us the highest speed when creating those persistent points. So there are two levels of indirections in our work, and the way that it goes is that the process has a virtual address space, which is composed of different pages. Those pages are grouped into chunks by the Lima virtual volume, and then when those are written, depending on the order that the applications create the persistent point, those chunks are going to be written to the physical volume in a particular way. All right. Okay. So having covered the design of our system and the architecture, let's now go to the evaluation. So in the evaluation, we focus on two configurations. So the first one is application level per system using a regular file system, and that is that here we would do what Sajid was saying. Let's say for a particular application, we make all the modifications necessary so that it becomes persistent, and then we compare that to modifications using SoftVM. One of the axes of our evaluation is the development complexity. So we implemented various data types and measured how many lines of code we added or needed for different types of things. And then we measured how they perform, right? So in the performance, based on microbenchmarks, for more one container, each container has data structures of a single type, and we vary the amount of data we write to each container, and also then make random updates in order to make 30 different portions of the memory. And also vary the locality of those updates, right? Okay, so first, the complexity measure. So in this table, we have five different data structures and the lines of code it took to implement application level persistence. And we further divide them into, this is the total lines of code. And this is how many lines of code it takes to make this this particular application persistent, and this is how much it takes to recover the state after it's persistent. And the same for SoftVM. So notice that for some applications, in particular for binary tree and hash table, the recovery code is more than 50% of the code, which, like I that means that you're actually gonna that half of the code is just recovery, which introduces a significant amount, margin for error, right? And with SoftVM, the developer just needed to add two lines to make it persistent and one line to restore it, right? And it was fairly constant. And the reason it's fairly constant is this. Because it's a small toy example, right? Yes?
Yeah. Can I also recommend for the complexity measure, if you can use coupling and cohesion, because your coupling will tell you how data in one module is reaching out to data in another module. So, because
okay.
you will have to follow that, and then you also have the sort of internal coupling within the module mm-hmm. versus the external. And maybe down the road, what you can do is use a combination of these metrics to profile your system to see if it actually is nice for this sort of thing or not based on these metrics.
Okay. So basically what they measure is how the system, the different components in the
right.
system.
Data. So if you have a reference to one object, say to another, mm-hmm. then that will be coupling that you would mean if you're making this persistent, you would mm-hmm. also have to follow that reference to make that piece persistent as well.
Okay.
So that's something to think about.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Okay, so So then we ran this and basically got this following performance. So like I said again, these are preliminary results. Actually, this is a little bit outdated. Currently, we have significantly better results. And notice that the time it takes to persist is very small in all cases.
What is the y-axis?
Oh, sorry. The y-axis is relative execution time. So we basically ran the application level persistent version and got this one line here, and then ran the soft PM version and got a different time and compared those times, right? So application level persistent is always going to be one because it's what we compare against, right? So if we look at particularly the binary tree, we see that it takes us a very, very significant, a really small amount of time to make it persistent, right? Even if we do those modifications and all that. And the reason for this is that those that I mentioned in the beginning, right? You only, if you only write what actually changed, it's very small the amount of changes that you have from one persistent point to another. For different data structures, that grows, and in particular, for an array, it remains fairly constant, the amount of data that you write, because simply an array doesn't have many pointers, and it's usually allocated within a contiguous region of memory, and if you modify it, well, you have to write it completely, right? So, in the recovery restore phase, where at the time we created this number, we were a little bit worse. But the last time that I ran it, we're actually probably less than half of what the results are showing here. And the reason that we were that bad in this point in time is that we were using our in particular, the structure will restore the pointer list in the page in the container page table was unoptimized. So that caused this bar to be so high, because every time we inserted an element in that list, we had to practically go through the whole list, and we had fixed that since. And now this is probably in this range. So for the time for this are all smaller. Okay, so this other experiment is basically this same experiment, but looked at in a different way. So here we decompose each of those bars into how many times it takes to serialize or do the discovery and do the write. And then on the restore part, how many times it takes to deserialize, do the fixing of pointers and do the read, right? So the way that you read this graph is that, again, the y-axis is normalized execution time, and for B3, these two signify the application level persistence. Right, that is always one, and this is the application level persistent creation of the persistent point, and this is the soft PN creation of the persistent point. This is the application error persistent restoration of the persistent point, and this is the soft PN version restoration of the persistent point. And that is for all of the oops, for all of the elements in the graph, right? So in particular for the V tree, we see that the time it takes to serialize and to write is about the same, because it's basically the way we implemented it was a recursive function that searches into the tree and makes recursive calls to write the tree. And in the case of SoftPN, it's a very minimal amount of time that you take to do the discovery in comparison to the time it takes to write it to disk. However, notice that when we're restoring, it's actually a lot worse, particularly because of the problem I mentioned with the pointer list that we had, and that is it's now fixed, so this bar should be lower. There's another issue is that if you look at strings and arrays, they don't have much pointers, right? So a string is just a sequential a stream of data that is continuously allocated, and you just have a pointer to the first element in the string. And the same thing with arrays. So there are not any pointers, and most of the time you're simply doing reads or write operations. And that's why we don't see much performance improvement there. Another experiment that we did is that we look at what happens when you vary the locality of the writes. Right? So in this particular case, that structure that we use is a list, and we updated and we simply modified different portions of the list and see. So a locality of 0% means that we modify any random element in the list, and a locality of 100% means that we're always modifying the same element in the list. And then we simply vary that, and we also vary the size of the elements of the list. And notice that that basically when you have more locality, the time it takes you to do a checkpoint is significantly smaller, and the reason is because we're not writing all the data all the time. We're simply writing whatever change, right? So when we reach to 100%, this is the minimal amount of data that we can actually write. Okay? So additionally, we looked at how does our system scale, right? So on the y-axis, again, it's relative execution time. On the x-axis, is we vary the number of concurrent threads that we're creating persistent points, right? So notice that although typically when you have multiple people writing at the same time, your time always increases, right? There's no way that it's going to decrease. However, since we're comparing against a default solution that writes that doesn't have all the write optimizations that we have, when our relative execution time always decreases, right? And as the number of threads scales, we tend to do significantly better than the other solutions. Right? Okay. So there are some cases where SoftPM is not good, and I think it's important to mention it. And the first one is unstructured data. Data where you simply, that it's very easy to serialize, and in that, and for instance, it doesn't have any pointers, just like I said, streams of audio or video. And the reason that we're not good there is that it's just a stream of data. And when we do our analysis of that data, we're not going to find anything. So we waste a little time doing that analysis, and then we're just simply going to do the write the same way that traditional checkpoints do. So that's why it's not, we don't achieve better performance there. for data that gets that doesn't typically get modified in place. Also another example when we don't do good. And when only subsets of data structure must be serialized. I'm not going to go into the details of why those other two examples are not relevant, but if you want, you can come and ask me later. Also, there are still some unresolved design issues that we have to tackle. For instance, right now our containers can only grow to the size of, I think it's 4 gigabytes, and this is something that we have to address in the near future. The reason they can only grow into 4 gigabytes is because our page table is only 32 bits addressable, so that only allows you to address 4 gigabytes. Memory exclusion, this is a very important point, and this is you may want your the closure calculation to exclude a memory portion that you treat in a different way in your program. So you may want to have some region of memory, let's say, that even though you have pointers there, let's say you don't use them as pointers, right? Typically when you have unions and stuff like that. And for that particular type of memory, you want to exclude it from being discovered. And also, how do we share a container among another process, right? For instance, I mentioned that during the discovery process, we move memory around from one location to another. So if you're having multiple processes executing at the same time, accessing that memory region that you just moved, you're going to have a failure, right? So there needs to be a way to address that problem of notifying another processes that you move that portion of memory. Okay, so to summarize, we provided a memory extraction for persistent data that allows fully automated discovery of data and persistence. That persistence is transactional persistence. That means it's atomic, either it completes or it fails. It's also very fast. We have planned branching and versioning support. And today I only covered high-performance computing applications, but there are actually many other fields where it applies to, in particularly, and actually when we initially designed it, we were thinking about self-managing storage and file systems, and it can also apply to databases. Actually, one of the applications that we're working on right now is making a particular database called SQLite persistent using software persistent memory. So in future directions, in the near term, we plan to implement demand loading chunks so that the whole container doesn't have to be loaded in memory for the application to start. We can just load it on demand when the application starts actually requesting a page of memory. Have real-world applications use SoftVM. SQLite is one of the first of those applications that is going to use it. And also experiment with large-scale parallel file system, which is what our design is intended to do. In the long term, we plan to add record replay and branching execution branching functionalities, as well as support for another languages. I will now, before I finish, I would like to mention that this is not only my work. There are a whole bunch of other people involved. In the core functionality, there is Leonardo, the two Daniels, Professor Raju, and Professor Jin Peng. In parallel file system, it's mainly being developed by Ricardo and Ning Zhao. And integration with other applications, we have some students under supervision of Professor Jason, and a collaborator from Sandia National Labs. And, well, this is my final slide, and I would like to thank you all for attending, and happy to take questions. Sure.
Okay, so you're dealing with PHP applications, which are like high performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, usually if you have a small error, like a bit flip or a couple bits being flipped,
mm-hmm.
and then you, after you say you will do your recovery, you have some bits flipping, then you start to run your program for another 3 days. This bit flip could be
propagated.
So how do you ensure, what methods of you taking to ensure the correctness of your implementation?
Yeah, so when we write to this, we make sure that what we're writing, we add an additional metadata that it's basically a checksum for that memory that we wrote to this, so that when we load it, we check if it's valid, if it's what we're reading actually matches what we wrote, right? And that's the main memory protection that we're making, right? So in terms of when we move, we assume that memory, once it's, if it's RAM memory, is going to be in a consistent state. So even if when we move it around, we're not going to introduce any bugs there. But there might be bugs when we write it to this. So and we add that additional layer of checking. Yes.
Do you plan to do any evaluations on real high performance computing?
Yes. So so that's coming in the future. Right now we're mainly focusing on getting some applications to work, and after those work and we have good and we have a system working good under those applications, we will move to the high performance applications. In particular, that's why we have the collaboration with Ron at Sandia, that they use a lot of those high-performance applications. Actually, the images I had in the beginning are from simulations run at Sandia, right? And in that point, Dulcado's work is going to be very important, because the way we write those checkpoints is mainly going to sorry, the efficiency of the checkpoint is mainly gonna is gonna be determined by the efficiency of our parallel file system driver. Yes.
From what you're saying, you said that this is a high performance system that's gonna run for a very long years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bug that causes the system to crash. That was
mm-hmm.
Do you envision that eventually will be able to allow the developer to fix the bug, fix the data,
yeah,
and restart?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So when you're running in a high-performance environment, there are two types of failures that could occur. Either your application crash or the system crash, the node where you were executing crash. So we target both of those. And in particularly, that's one of the advantages that we have over traditional checkpointing, that is that we just ensure that the data is consistent, right? If the in traditional checkpointing solutions, what happens is that they checkpoint the whole process. So even if you make a small modification in the process and you restart the process, that checkpoint is not going to be usable anymore, because that checkpoint contains the code and the stack of the application. So the execution stack will likely change, and the code will definitely change. So that checkpoint is no longer valid, right? Whereas in our solution, since we're only checkpointing the data, then you can safely recover the piece of data, and possibly, and let's say you want to make a modification, you recover it, create a new container, and move data around, and you're not going to lose your data just because you made a small change in your application. That's a very, very good point, that an advantage that we have over those methods. Okay, good. Yes?
I guess there's some synchronization, right? You only checkpoint the data, but the program state, you don't,
yes,
don't checkpoint me. So when you do recover, how do you...
Yeah, okay, so I unpurposely bypassed all that during this presentation, and the reason is that we have like we have data containers, we plan to have execution containers. and those executions contain the state of the application, right? So those will contain the stack and allow you to recover execution to a specific point in time. And that's one option that the developer has. The other option is that the developer will need to specify to know how to recover from JIT data. So he will have to probably include additional amount of data in the root container to allow him to know at which point in execution he was. So let's say if he was multiplying a matrix, he will need to store the index of the element that he was actually multiplying, right? But it can be substantially more complicated for more complex applications. Yes?
Is there any other research going on regarding persistent memory?
So most of the research that we're aware of it's either on full application checkpointing or system level checkpointing. In terms of application directed checkpointing, that is what we do. There is some previous work. However, that previous work has a significant amount of limitations that we do address, and try to and also our system is broader than all the previous work that at least we know we are aware of. Yes.
So that question relates to your experiment results in terms of comparing your performance against the application level of the system. So first is the question, what is application level of the system? Or what is the, you did something that you can sort of theorize?
Yes, so those experiments, I coded the serialization and deserialization of that data, and I also coded the part where the application knows where to start, where to restart after the data is recovered, and that's why I compare against.
Right. Yeah. So that's what my comment is. If that's the case, I mean, there are increasing research or apps related to application direction in the U.S.
It's a valid point. It's something that we should definitely explore in the future.
Yeah, because you are comparing.
Yes.
Especially, you're saying this is like what sort of the code that you are, you know, application directed checkpointing using probably two statements.
Well, actually, no, because the only application level directed checkpoint is a word that was very influential. It was, I think, from 10 years ago, and that work requires you to manually annotate the code and specify which memory to put in each container, right? So it's not as flexible as SoftPN that will automatically discover that, but it requires the developer to specify what data is persistent and what data isn't, and that is and they later came up with a paper saying that just identifying that is very, very difficult, and it actually introduced the most amount of bugs in their code.
What I'm curious about is if you're saving any of this stuff out of, say, file system, any data that you're saving is now more vulnerable.
Well, it's true, but let me see. Okay, so yeah, well, it's true that saving data gives you requires you to be more cautious when you save that data. You could possibly encrypt it so that shows that an attacker will not just read it and know what it is. But also, there's also one point is that for someone to interpret your data, it needs to know how it is arranged, right? So you would need to know that you're storing a container and what that page table looks like and all that. So it's I mean, it's definitely possible, and but it, I guess it's a problem that's there with all checkpointing solutions, right? Any checkpointing solutions that writes the application state to disk is gonna have that potential security problem. Yes.
Why exactly in SQLite you wanna make a system? Because most reasonable good database management systems already have.
Yeah. So.
Various mechanisms.
Yeah. So SQLite has an option that allows you to run a database in memory that is significantly faster than running databases that are this bad. And that in-memory database, we want to make it persistent. And that's the one that we're particularly targeting at.
And what will be your root in this case?
So, well, your root will be, so SQLite has a structure called DB. And your root will simply be a pointer to that DB structure. That DB structure contains then pointers to tables and the state and logs and a whole bunch of stuff. And your root will just simply be a pointer to that DB structure. And that's it. Because the memory closure will then include all that in persistent memory. Okay.
One question. In the area of the fault tolerance in, let's say, cluster environments, there are existing solutions that have proven to be useful and very effective and in the order of thousands of nodes, for example, MapReduce from Google or Triad from Microsoft.
Yeah.
They implement a different way, but they tackle the problem of fault tolerance in a slightly different way, right? Not using checkpointing, but how would you compare your work against those existing words and what are the strengths probably?
Yeah. So when I mention high performance computing, you have to take into account who the user is, right? So the developer will not typically be computer scientists, but physicists, mathematics, another type of scientist, right? And the first thing is that you will not expect them to know the concepts and how to use MapReduce, because MapReduce it requires you a significant understanding of how to make transformations on the data and then how to put all that together. That's one point, right? So typically the applications that we've seen are simple vector multiplications, matrix multiplications, and the hard stuff is what they actually do to get that data, right? It's mostly calculations. It's not the data structure that are really complex, but the calculations that you do with the data. So the point being that I wouldn't expect those scientists to learn how to program MapReduce applications, right? Because there's also this whole history of libraries that they already work with. And
right, so that problem has already been tackled, in fact, in the MapReduce domain by constructing additional layers on top of MapReduce that, for example, there's a project called Hive that provides a SQL interface to a HDFS file system such that the users only express their analytics in terms of a SQL-like statement, and this transforms into a MapReduce. So there are, like, currently there's like different levels of interfaces for different types of skills.
Yeah. So again, I mean, those scientists still use Fortran. I wouldn't expect them to make all the Fortran code they have SQL based, right? So, I mean, it's there now. It's going to be there for a lot more time to come, and that would be my.
The other point which I was discussing with you yesterday is that the MapReduce world is based on very different kinds of assumptions. It is based on the assumption that you can break up your computation into small enough parts, a large number of small enough portions that you can afford to lose computations of a single portion. So if the node dies, you just restart the whole thing because you've already broken it up into small enough parts that execution times are small. Whereas these class of applications, because they are compute intensive and not data intensive, they run for much longer periods of time. So checkpointing is inherently necessary. Whereas for the MapReduce, class of applications, they're not driven by checkpointing. They're driven by re-execution. So I would say that using something like SoftVM for MapReduce today does not make much sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I also want to make a comment here. So checkpointing has been in existence for 10 years.
Yeah.
So I would argue that what you just said about the existing library, I think you were mentioning to
No, RBN. That's the one I was particularly.
So their existing solution actually making this idea of internal slash identify the regions that are vulnerable regions that actually can you know just call a function to be able to just check on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the good point of the SoftVM has to be going beyond the checkpoint. And you mentioned some of the other capabilities haven't actually got it come into those capabilities. But I think that's where this actually really distinguish from the existing approaches and be able to sort of have containers that serialize data and have multiple containers and different sort of a state for different times. And so they can explore different execution functions. And these are the capabilities not actually.
Okay, so I thank Corey for this.
Okay. So that was very good.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, you spoke a lot, so. Yeah, I had some comments, right? And I think first of all, HEC is high end computing, not high energy. It's high end computing. But that's easy. I think that you did a pretty good job today. I mean, overall, it was fairly clear. But I think, I mean, when you go back and listen to this, think from the perspective of a person who doesn't know anything about SoftVM and see if you're providing all the information in the right sequence, right? Because it's difficult. With this project, it's quite difficult because there's so many concepts and there's so many things that you can talk about. So it is important to also simplify
terminology.
The terminology has to be reduced maybe and simplified, but also consistent, right? So at some point we started talking about chunks, which was not introduced, and which was introduced to some extent, but you were using that term interchangeably with pages. So it was so things like if we can reduce the number of terminology in the talk, I think that would be useful. But if you want to use a certain terminology, use it. Try to use it consistently. So I think there are some minor improvements that you can certainly make along that direction. Right, what else did I have in mind? Right. So I think it was also, I think there's a long enough talk. With long talks, you have to sort of pace yourself a little bit, and I think you did pretty good in that regard in terms of how you managed your time.
Yeah, I was constantly looking at.
I think that was really good. I think you did a very good job in terms of managing your time. So that was quite good, and I think some of, for instance, the storage I/O driver, there were some issues with the descriptions. I think could have been further simplified.
Okay.
What else? I think the illustrations were all great. I think they really helped a lot. And I saw that you chose to do the discovery and then later on the architecture. I think it worked fine in the end. I thought that the example for discovery should go where we introduced discovery, but I think what you did was also okay. It's an alternative. What else? right? So I think if you have, you know, I know Sajeev sort of used up a little bit of your time. You have to sort of deal with questions a little bit more, I think, diplomatically, right? And because if there is one person in the audience who asks you a question and keeps asking you a question, you can say things like, yeah, that's an important point, but I think we can take this offline or something like that. So you can certainly do that. It's not a problem. And, I mean, at a conference, you don't have that issue because all questions come at the end. But in a talk like this, especially if you're going for a job talk or something like that, because you want to manage your time carefully. What else? I think that's it. I think, I mean, a general comment is when you're speaking, right, it helps to be aware of what you're saying, right, consistently, right, the words that you're going to speak, and control that a little better.
The thing is that I didn't have enough time to practice it.
No. You did actually very good, but I'm saying that this is an ongoing process,
mm-hmm.
right? You get, each time you do a talk, you get better, and the next time you get better. But the way you get better is by being super aware of what you're saying, right? So you have to consistently, like a policeman, monitor what you're saying. That has worked for me, at least. The other thing that you could do is to, you know, when you're having technical discussions, be super aware in those sort of situations also. Don't sort of relax and use words loosely, right? And when you start doing that, then you start becoming much more precise in your formal talks. So that's something that you're already doing pretty well, but certainly there is room for improvement. Right. So the other thing I was going to suggest is that I did record my Sandia talk.
Okay.
I don't know if, so it's on the wiki page. I've posted it.
So we should have, did you put it on presentations or something?
I put it in the section where we have, brainstorming sessions and talk.
Okay, at the end.
So I'll put this one also there. So you can also...
Yeah, I could also put this presentation, so...
Yeah, you can put the presentation as well. Yeah. And so you can also, you know, listen to that and see a different way in which perhaps this can be presented, because some of the descriptions are not that easy. For instance, when you had this indirection summary, it's tricky when you have to present it. And I know that you were running short of time at that point, so you tried to speed that up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important that if you show a slide, you actually describe what's in the slide completely, right? So people understand at least to a large extent. So that one slide comes to mind, which was perhaps a little, the description was a little loose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also struggled to explain that slide. I explained the same slide at Sandia, so you can perhaps learn a couple of things and about how we can do that and improve upon that. So yeah, descriptions are always tricky, and the more you discuss the subject, the richer vocabulary you have to talk about things, because you start viewing the same thing from different angles and you have more intuitive explanations for it. But I thought you had some really good examples. I think you connected with the audience, and that's really important. I think the examples help a lot. I didn't have examples, so many examples. In fact, I don't think I had any example at all during my talk. So that makes it a little bit...
The restore and...
Oh, yeah, that example, yeah, I did have that. So, yeah, that certainly helped. But I think, you know, your example-driven talk was much more informative than the talk I gave. So, yeah, listen to that talk, and because I know you're going to give this presentation again in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So what did you think about your presentation? Were there... things that you
I would have liked to rehearse it more, especially that latter part. Because at the beginning, I mean, the few slides, I knew exactly what to say initially.
It was,
but as I went on,
there were slides that you didn't see before, I guess.
No, I at least read them and had some idea of what to say, but
yeah,
I mean, since I didn't rehearse it that much,
mm.
Because I just finished it, well, because basically I'm overwhelmed with the work that's been going on, and
yeah,
dedicated like a day and a half.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think you did great. I'm just trying to give you some feedback to make you better than what you did, right? And you did really well.
No, it's great. And particularly, I would want to ask you, I mean, how did I do on the questions? Because sometimes
I think you really did good on all the questions except for the last question, which Ariel asked.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could have answered it in a very different way
because
the domain that these scientific applications work in and the MapReduce domain, which is data intensive,
mm-hmm.
these guys are compute intensive. This huge difference. These applications do not read much data at all, right? Whereas the MapReduce class of applications, they rely on ingesting a lot of data and putting out a lot of data. So it's a very different class of application. And like I said, when I was explaining or trying to answer Ariel's question, is that the whole MapReduce world is based on it is highly parallelizable and there is no inter-process communication because they all independently operate. So if one dies, you can very easily restart the other guy, and the whole MapReduce is so effective because it's a highly parallelizable environment, easily, embarrassingly parallel solutions, right? For embarrassingly parallelizable solutions, problems. So therefore, since it's capable of splitting up into as many parts as you want, the actual execution time is not that high. So you don't have to worry about restarting or anything of that sort, right? So that could have been, differently addressed.
Okay.
But other questions were great. I think you had some really insightful answers, which even I won't have. So I think those were really good.
Okay. Yeah, I think that when Ariel asked, I started thinking, okay, because at some point we discussed about adding SoftVM to MapReduce, and then I think, okay, that I was trying to contradict myself and looking at why wouldn't it make sense?
Mm. Because
I just didn't.
Yeah, so these sorts of questions, right? I mean, you already did that. I think with Ariel's question, you could have spent a little bit more time thinking about it, right? And sometimes it helps to just take a few seconds, 10, 15 seconds to 20 seconds of silence to just think about the question and different ways of answering the question. So that certainly helps.
Okay.
But yeah, I have to say that you did really well, and I think I can see that you're getting better with each presentation. So that's a very positive sign.
Yeah, but I think presentation is something that you always have to do, because if you stop doing this, then you sort of lose it also.
Right, and I mean, to help you, if you want, you can also act as a substitute teacher for one of my lectures at some point for more practice.
Yeah, that could help. Definitely.
Right. Yeah, so we can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, probably not this semester since you're not teaching anything, but probably.
Yeah. It is more appropriate. It's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, that would be useful.
Okay. All right. Good.
Back to work.
And I'll send you the.
Yeah. Yeah, the wiki would be fine. That way I didn't notice that the other